It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Federal cuts and funding freezes mean that food banks across the country and here in Wisconsin have less to give out to a growing number of people who are food insecure. The organization Feeding America estimates more than 600,000 Wisconsinites are facing hunger. And now the group reports that the Trump administration has slashed about $1 billion in federal aid to anti-hunger groups, and those cuts are starting to set in at local food banks. We're hearing from two Wisconsin organizations about the impact of funding reductions and the level of need. In Dane County, Way Forward Resources provides food pantry and other services. Leslie Albrecht Huber is Senior Director of Development and Community Engagement. Leslie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin's Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement, Matt Steenstra, is here. Matt, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Matt, let's start with you. Your organization distributing food to 370 pantries and meal programs across 35 counties. How would you describe the need now?
Right now, the need is as great as it's been. So the increase in hunger has started really back in 2023. And what we've seen is a 30% increase in demand at our food pantries across all 370 partners that we see in our 35 counties. The increase in childhood hunger, we're in the middle of the greatest spike of childhood hunger since the Great Recession. So right now, demand is way up.
And Leslie, you serve people in need of housing and clothing and food. What are you seeing at Way Forward Resources for your food pantry services?
Yes, we are seeing record high demand. In fact, here in Dane County at Way Forward, we have three times as many visits as we did just 2 years ago. So as you can imagine, that is an increase that is very difficult and challenging for us to keep up with.
What do you think is causing this spike?
We attribute it to three main factors. One is just the population growth that we've had in Dane County, especially here on the west side. It is also due to housing prices that have really squeezed people's incomes as they need to put more money toward rent. They have less money available for food, and so they come to a food pantry to make up that difference. And then the third reason is food inflation that is affecting everyone, but particularly those who were just making ends meet before.
Matt, in terms of that food inflation, I mean, we have seen some of that pressure cool off quite a bit in the past year, but now tariffs are expected to push prices higher again. Is the price of food causing families to rely on food banks?
Oh, sure. I mean, the price of food has been up for a while, and we saw this increase of visitors. We've seen it for years, but I think the big difference now is while we're seeing this increase in demand, the demand has remained high, while the supply of food to be able to serve the line of people coming to food pantries has dropped precipitously over the past few years. It's the same. It's food costs. It's a number of different factors that families face, but our job is to make sure that food pantries can have whatever they need to make sure that they can serve their communities.
And your national food network, Feeding America, is projecting that the government would spend $2 billion on aid to food banks in this fiscal year. And what does this loss of funding mean to your organization? Where are you at with it?
I think it's really important to paint the picture about where we've been. As far as what we're facing and how we react, we're prepared and we're ready. This is not the first time something like this has happened, but we've been dealing with this for years. So I'd say 2022, the state of Wisconsin has already lost more than $1 billion in federal benefits and commodities that go directly to food pantries and families in need. So the recent loss of products through these different programs, whether it's a local food purchasing program where we can source food directly from farmers and get out to hard to reach areas, or stable commodity programs like the Emergency Food Assistance Program. What we're doing is we're really looking at how can we partner with other organizations and find ways to fill the gaps that exist. But this is something that food banks have encountered in the past, but there's a lot of uncertainty right now. And so what we're doing is we're looking to find ways that we can form partnerships and get more food out to communities to help plug the holes that have been left.
Leslie, will local communities and the local business community be able to make up this gap in funding from federal aid that goes for hunger relief? What is your take?
I think that is an open question. Like Matt has said, the amount of food that's coming to us through food banks has decreased. So we used to get nearly 50% of our food in this way, and now it's less than 30%. And so that is a larger percentage that we are having to make up on our own. And so we're doing exactly what you say. We're turning to private fundraising, we're turning to food drives and to businesses. We have seen our very generous communities step up and respond. But it has become more challenging, and will we be able to sustain that gap and filling that gap? We have found that while we have still never turned anyone away, people are leaving with less pounds per person than they were a couple of years ago because there's simply less food available on the shelves compared to the amount of people that are coming in.
We're talking with two Wisconsin organizations about the impact of federal funding cuts made to local food banks. Leslie Albrecht-Huber there, Senior Director of Development and Community Engagement at Way Forward Resources in Dane County. Matt Steenstra is here, Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement with Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. Matt, Feeding America has launched this Next Billion Meals Challenge to end hunger in America. It's a 10-year initiative. Will Wisconsin have the capacity to contribute to this effort?
Wisconsin has a very rich history of supporting our own communities, our own neighbors. That's right now today. I'm actually in Wausau, Wisconsin. I live down in the Waukesha, Milwaukee area because the state of Wisconsin is considering how we can form our own state budget to make investments that the communities and families need. We've formed tremendous partnerships over the course of the past few years through these programs where we're able to source food from farmers and get it to families. And we continue these partnerships. There's a ton of amazing food coalitions that we have across the state of Wisconsin, including in our footprint. Even since the cuts have happened, we have now worked with the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative to find almost 12 of the farmers that have lost the ability to get their food out to communities. And then we picked up those relationships to figure out how can we, on our own, support getting these farmers' food out to the families in need just like they were before.
So this Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, you're having to make those direct connections and kind of repair this supply chain, if you will.
You know, our mission is to solve hunger, but oftentimes we switch from solving hunger to serving. And this is one of those times where we just figure that we have to pivot and we got to look around and see who are the people that can support us, who are the people that we can support, and you make it work.
Leslie, what type of statewide solutions, legislative solutions should be, maybe put into motion at the state level to support food banks and pantries in this moment?
Matt is probably a better answer to that question, but we have been working with Feeding Wisconsin in their efforts to get funding for food banks into the state budget. Wisconsin is only one of a handful of states that doesn't provide that now. And with the growing need, we feel like that is going to be imperative to keep the people in Wisconsin having the access to healthy food that they need. Instead of simply relying on food pantries like us, who are becoming more and more innovative and relying more and more on the support of our community, which is wonderful. But if we could have that stable foundation, that would really give us a head start.
What is one thing you've done to innovate? Can you give an example?
We have really been focusing on our messaging this year because we have found that a lot of people don't know, don't realize, don't understand that gap in food, that 1 in 10 households in our state are food insecure. And so we have been offering community education sessions where we invite people in to talk to them about what's going on with food. And we have found that when people have that information, they are more empowered to act and to support our work, either through financial donations as volunteers, which is very important because our food pantry has only three staff in it, and the rest of the work is done by volunteers, or also to go back to their businesses, organize a group engagement, organize a food drive. So we have been working on connecting with the community, helping them to be aware of what is happening so that they are able to respond and support us.
Matt, what do you want local communities and individuals to know in order to step up as they hear this in this moment?
I want folks to know a couple things. That first, that we're here for you. That Feeding America East Wisconsin and other food banks across the state are going to be working with their food pantries, their neighborhood communities, to make sure that they can have as much as possible to be able to serve the folks in line. But to know that there's a ton of resources out there. Most of the new families, the folks that are coming to these pantries right now, they're new families. This is where the increase is coming from. It's working families with kids. It's senior citizens. And when you come to a pantry for the first time, we want people to understand that you're going to have a dignified experience, that we're going to do our best to source food from Wisconsin growers that has been picked locally and given directly to food pantries so that they can get it to you, that your shopping experience should mirror what your grocery shopping experience should be like. We also want folks to know that if you don't need food, but you're looking for a way to pitch in, your local food banks and your local food pantries could really use the support right now. We have a big hole to fill. And the way that we do that is by Wisconsin families supporting with other Wisconsin families and chipping in and supporting so that we can leverage our purchasing power to buy more food, to be able to get it out to folks, or to contact your elected official and to let them know that the state of Wisconsin, can make investments too to help support these purchases. That would be huge.
Matt and Leslie, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much.
That is Matt Steenstra, Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement at Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, and Leslie Albrecht-Huber, Senior Director of Development and Community Engagement at Way Forward Resources based in Middleton. We've been learning about how anti-hunger groups and food banks are impacted by federal funding cuts and the level of need here in Wisconsin. Coming up, dig into the impact of online sports gambling after a court ruling that opened the door to online sports books.
There are lots of people, particularly young people, who were not betting before legalization, who have only gotten into the game because it's so accessible.
Plus, find out why Wisconsin is in a unique situation. That's next here in WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. If you watch sports, there is a good chance you've seen ads, logos, and other promotions for online sports gambling companies.
New customers bet $5 to get 200 instantly in bonus bets and a month of NFL Plus Premium.
New customers bet $5 to get 250 in bonus bets if you win.
Get up to a $1,500 new customer offer in bonus bets when you sign up now. Download and bet today.
But it hasn't always been that way. Before 2018, sports betting was mostly illegal, with the exception of some in-person sports books, mostly in Las Vegas. Things changed with a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that opened the doors for states to legalize gambling on sports. Now, over three dozen states have some kind of legal sports gambling, and online sports books like FanDuel and DraftKings, they're big business. That has raised concerns about the impact on sports and especially the risk of problem gambling. Jonathan D. Cohn talks about those risks in his new book. It's called Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. He's a program officer at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he talked with Rob Ferret about the rise of sports betting and Wisconsin's unique situation.
Let's go back to 2018. We got this Supreme Court decision that really changes the landscape for sports gambling in the United States. Can you talk about this new chapter, as you call it?
Yeah, so this is a dangerous question to ask a historian, but I'll take you back to sort of a short version of the history, which is that in the late 1980s, early 1990s, states were threatening, basically, to legalize sports gambling on their own, and Congress said no. Congress in 1992 passes the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, to protect all of our athletes and our young people, of course. What that bill did, it did not make sports gambling illegal, but it banned states from legalizing sports gambling. So on that basis, in 2018, was the Supreme Court decision that you mentioned, which rendered PASPA illegal or unconstitutional because Congress can't tell states what to do, rendering that that sports gambling is a state's rights issue and states should be free to decide the issue of sports betting for themselves.
So here it is with the states now. I want to put Wisconsin in the conversation for a moment. I was just brushing up on my Wisconsin Constitution. There's a pretty strong gambling ban with some exceptions in the Constitution. So we haven't joined states in legalizing online sports betting. But hang on, asterisk, we've got tribal sovereignty and there is sports gambling, sports books at in person at tribal casinos. How unique is that in the country with how states have tackled things since the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, it's fairly unique. Most states, I think 30 plus states, as of this conversation, it changes like every week. Most states have legalized sports gambling, have legalized online sports gambling. Wisconsin is unique. There are a few other upper Midwestern states in the same category that have legalized sports betting, but for whatever reason, have not gone all the way, have not gone all in, pun intended, to legalize online sports gambling. They see that as sort of the last bridge, or maybe a bridge too far even.
And people may wonder, well, hold on, the internet, how it right. doesn't stop at the state borders. How does the state say, no, you can't gamble here, even though if you cross that state line, you can gamble online there?
The internet doesn't stop at state borders, but it actually kind of does. DraftKings and FanDuel and all the other online providers of sports betting all partner with geolocation companies that have really, really precise location measurements on every single cell phone when you're using the app. And there are reports that even if you step across the border from Florida into Georgia, you know, they can pick up on the fact that you're over the border and they can cut you off because you're in a jurisdiction that no longer allows online sports betting.
I have encountered people who claim to have beaten that system and been able to gamble online
yes.
for Wisconsin. Good or bad for them, I don't know. But I'm guessing there are some loopholes that the technologically savvy can find.
Right. Well, it used to be, so this was the case with online poker for a long time, and there was this cafe on the side of a bridge in New Jersey that was notorious, where people would just drive over from New York and sit there in this cafe all day playing poker 50 feet from the state border, then drive back home in the evening. So maybe your friends in Wisconsin are basically doing the Midwestern version of that.
Okay, now let's get to the fallout from this 2018 decision. As you mentioned, 30-plus states go effectively all in on gambling. This happened, as you describe in the book, pretty quickly in a lot of states. What did that process look like?
We're soon this year going to have 39 different sports gambling states, so we have 39 different stories. But in general, it looked like states, starting with Delaware, 6 weeks after the Supreme Court decision, rolling out retail, so in person, you know, at a sports book, sports betting, followed by, you know, maybe a year or two later, online sports betting. And just to provide sort of a frame of reference, it took us 30, 40 years of state lotteries to get to almost 40 states. And we're going to hit our 39th state in just 7 years later this year. So it rolled out extremely quickly. And again, subject to local conditions. And in many states, it was the companies, the gambling companies that came in, that wrote gambling legislation, that drafted the regulations to the govern gambling. And they were responsible or partly responsible for getting the games up quickly and for getting the games designed in such a way that suited the interests of the sports books.
Let's look at some of the things that have changed. You mentioned those efforts to pass that law in Congress. Some of the organizations most opposed to legalized sports gambling were the sports organization, the NFLs and Major League Baseball and things like that. Now anybody who watches sports sees official partner gambling agencies. How did we get this 180?
Yeah, so So we got the 180 slowly and then all at once. Back in 2014, Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, wrote a sort of landmark op-ed in the New York Times calling for a reversal of PASPA, calling for a new approach when it comes to legalized sports gambling. But sort of as you're alluding to, as long as sports gambling was illegal or was not legal, the leagues could not endorse it. And they, in fact, spent many years, many decades punching down at gambling and talking about how much they dislike gambling, how much of a threat gambling is to the integrity of their game. But then lo and behold, come 10:01 a.m. on May 14th, 2018, they are yet another institution that is able to go all in on gambling, because if gambling is going to be legal, then they can make money off of it. They will make money off of it, and they can use it to drive interest in their product. So the complete 180 is now, oh, not gambling is a threat to the integrity of our product, but by giving gambling a nice bear hug, by keeping it as close to our product as possible, and by we can monitor it, we can be safe about it, we can detect if an athlete is betting or not, and by the way, we can make billions of dollars on it every single year.
Talking to Jonathan Cohen about his new book, Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. Jonathan, let's turn to the people now making the bets. One of the arguments for legalization that you highlight being made over the years in the book is, hey, people are gambling already. They're gambling illegally. That's bad. States are getting a taste of that. They might have criminal retribution if they don't pay their debts. It's going to be safer and happier and more lucrative for everybody if it's legal. The idea is, okay, these legal things are just taking all that illegal business and transferring it over. Has that been the case, or have we seen gambling expand because of this?
So it has sort of been the case. We have absolutely, with no doubt, seen gambling expand, meaning there are lots of people, particularly young people, who were not betting before 2018 or not betting before legalization, who have only gotten into the game because it's so accessible, because they can bet in many states on their phone, you know, using a credit card, using a debit card. So first of all, that already you see sort of the holes in the argument where you're getting a new generation of gamblers, you know, again, specifically young people on board. And then you're also seeing this curious phenomenon where the legal market is not actually displacing the illegal market in many instances. You know, bookies, for example, will let you bet on credit. You don't need to front every dollar for every bet. You can just call them up and say, hey, I want, you know, $10,000 on the bucks or whatever. And, you know, they'll break your kneecaps if you don't pay, but you don't have to actually give them $10,000 on the spot. And for offshore casinos too, you know, it's nice for big volume bettors. Come tax season, they don't have to report any of their winnings. So I'm not saying these are good behaviors or that we should endorse the black market, but it was sort of naive of politicians, and it was a little surreptitious of the companies to claim that all of this illegal money will automatically sort of magically appear in legal coffers without any consideration of why people actually are choosing to play on the black market.
And then there's the access to what people bet on. And when you think of sports betting, you think, I'm going to bet on the football game, right? This team's going to win, or this team's going to cover the spread, or whatever, or the over-under, whatever the case may be. Now you can go online and, you know, hey, I'm going to bet on the 10th match in this tennis tournament in Hong Kong, right, at 3
in
the morning.
Well, Rob, you're a huge Malaysian women's doubles badminton fan, right?
Right, exactly. I can't get enough information here, frankly. Yeah, but it's you can literally go on and bet on anything, any sporting event going on anywhere in the world, it seems like.
Yeah, and even more to the point, not just any sporting event in the world, but also any sort of fractional event,
right,
in a sporting event. So you're watching the Packers game, and it's not just, you know, who's going to win the game, but like, will this drive end in a touchdown? Will the next play be a running play? Will the next play be a running play for more than 1.5 yards? And the thesis behind all of this, the idea behind all of this, is to create as many opportunities for action as possible. People who are addicted to gambling, especially, but even people who are not, you know, they're not just looking to win money. They're looking for chances to get money down and things to bet on and ways to create excitement. So what you're doing is, you know, by offering Malaysian women's doubles badminton bets, you know, you're giving people in the middle of the night who have nothing else to watch, no sports on, a chance to bet on something. And then you're also giving an incentive to bet on the Packers game, but then to keep your DraftKings app open and to keep betting over the course of the game, because any single play, any single moment in the game could be an opportunity to win money or to bet money. And that is what this is so beyond what was imagined in 2018 when the Supreme Court, decided this issue, and it is a new frontier, absolutely, in American gambling.
And Jonathan, that takes us to the most heartbreaking parts of your books, what you call an epidemic of problem gambling. You point out not everybody who gambles, most people who gamble won't have an addiction, but there's been a growth in gambling addiction since this happened. What are we seeing?
Yeah, so the data on this is a little uncertain, so I'll caveat it with that. But there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, especially that young people, in particular the young men, are either developing, you know, full-on gambling addictions or at least engaging in what you could call hazardous or problematic or at-risk play, where they are, you know, periodically losing more money than they can afford, losing more money than they intend, you know, developing these sort of episodic gambling addiction where, you know, you might not have a real full-blown gambling addiction for the rest of your life, but you sort of go through a weird six-month period where you come out of the rabbit hole and you're just like, what just happened? Like, how did I just lose $15,000 over the course of 6 months? So you're seeing a lot of, again, sort of anecdotal evidence of that from high school teachers who reach out to me, from gambling therapists, from people who run gambling hotlines, all reporting not just an increase in use of their service and an increased interest in their in therapy and in treatment, but it particularly a new demographic that it is now younger people, again, younger men in particular, more than before, who are taking advantage of these services and who need treatment for gambling related harms.
You share a couple stories, and one that you go through the book with. We meet Kyle. You call him Kyle in the book. Share a little bit of his story and how he really descended into problem gambling.
Yeah, and he sort of embodies this sort of episodic character where he had been to a casino a couple times in his life, and it was fine. You know, he bet safely. He didn't get over his skis. You know, he was able to bet you know, responsibly. And then Colorado legalized sports gambling in 2020, and he got really excited. He downloaded every different app, and he fell into one of these rabbit holes that I mentioned of, you know, losing more money than he intended. His dad needed to bail him out, but then he kept falling down, and every time there'd be a major tennis tournament, he would, you know, go 40 hours without sleeping because he'd stay up all night to watch the games or to watch the matches, and he lost his job because of it. He had to move back in with his parents in Kansas, and you know, even when I talked to him for the book, he still, every time there's a major tennis tournament, he sort of it happens all over again. He until recently didn't have a source of income and sort of saw this as a way to make money. Of course, he doesn't actually make money. Many gamblers have this false sense that they're making money when they aren't. And by his own admission, he would never have been gambling, not to mention gambling on minor league British darts at 3 a.m, if it wasn't available on his phone, you know, at the touch of a button. And this is these are the consequences of not just legalized sports gambling, but the ways we have rolled it out and the ways that we've rolled it out so quickly, and we've rolled it out online in particular so quickly.
And one of the biggest criticisms I've seen, not just in your book, but elsewhere, of the online sports books is the lack of sufficient efforts, people would say, to find people like Kyle and keep them from gambling, because they are a really solid source of revenue for these companies. What kind of safeguards do exist? What could improve things?
So there are a couple safeguards in place, but not really. I mean, the safeguards that are in place, for example, are for real sports betting, for technical sports betting. You know, you need to prove that you're over 18 or that you're over 21. Some states don't let you bet with credit cards and so on. But the vast majority of these guardrails are optional. You know, you have the option of setting up a deposit limit. You have the option of setting up a time limit on the app. And you know, as you can imagine, the companies like it that way. The companies like it that it's optional, that it's up to you, the gambler, not this billion-dollar sports book, to set a limit for yourself and to define what responsible play is for you. And that's why advocates like myself and lawmakers have called for making some of these guardrails required. You know, if you deposit money into your account, you can't gamble with it right away. You have to wait 24 hours or 12 hours so that you can't start chasing all of your losses. The companies could do this themselves, and I wish they would, and they would self-regulate, but it doesn't seem like they're going to, which is, again, why it has sort of fallen to people outside of the private sector to call for making them required to protect people like Kyle and prevent them from falling into these harms in the first place.
But it's kind of the opposite thing happens. I think it was Kyle gets VIP treatment. There are staff at some of these sports books who say, hey, this person looks like they're going to spend a lot of money. We want to make sure they keep spending a lot of money with us. And so we're going to give them some perks and things like that and keep them betting. How does that VIP system work?
Yeah, it's exactly as you described, whereas they, you know, these companies have more data on their gamblers than any gambling operation in recorded human history. And they can figure out who is going to bet, how much they're going to bet, and who might, you know, if with a little human nudges, right, with someone in their ear offering them tickets to a football game, you know, a free iPhone, you name it, to incentivize them to play more, and then also to build brand loyalty and to say, oh, you know, if you're betting a lot of money, we want you to bet all of it with FanDuel. You know, we don't want you to go to these other sports books, and we'll reward you. We'll give you trophies. We'll give you this. You know, and you can imagine how much someone has to be losing, how much money they have to be gambling away in order for that to be a profitable enterprise for the companies. But, you know, this has been a longstanding practice in the casino industry. And it's now even worse, I think, with sports betting, because you can bet from your phone. You don't have to be at the casino, right, to be losing money. You could be doing it any single minute of the day, betting on Malaysian women's doubles badminton.
You mentioned the need for more safeguards for problem gamblers and other changes in the industry. Who would that have to come from, assuming it's not going to come from the industry itself? State by state, Congress, where?
So, yeah, either one, state or Congress. You know, of course, every state regulates, you know, per the Supreme Court decision, every state regulates its own sports gambling. And there is a state regulatory body that could say, you know, okay, the new law in Wisconsin or in Kansas or wherever is, you know, you can only gamble this much per day. You can only log into your app this number of times, and so on. States, as we've talked about, sort of make money from sports gambling and are often loath to pull back on the way that gambling has been rolled out. So there is a bill, as you've already described, in Congress that would do exactly what we've been talking about, which is sort of set a floor under sports gambling, meaning, okay, states, you can offer sports gambling, but you need to limit advertising in this way. You need to spend this much money on problem gambling. You need to ban the use of AI to develop specialized player tools or player props to try to entice players and so on. So it could come from the state. It could come from Congress. I'm a little skeptical it's ever going to come from either, but I'm hopeful.
Jonathan, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Good luck.
That is Jonathan D. Cohen. He talked with Rob Ferret about his new book, Losing Big, America's Reckless Bet on Sports Gambling. Coming up, we visit a UW woodworking studio and discover the joy of creating arts and crafts with wood.
Wood is one of those materials where you really have to listen to it. It has a grain, it has a direction, and when you're working with it, you have to be paying attention to what it's saying.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At Katie Hudnall's lab on UW-Madison's campus, students are making art out of trees.
You're not really fine lines, right?
Yeah. I mean, they don't have to be super fine, but an eighth of an inch.
Okay. Let's do a test with both of these and see which one turns out best.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Cool.
Hudnall leads the university's woodworking and furniture program, one of a small group of artistic woodworking programs in the country. She describes wood as a magical medium that people have an intimate relationship with, but know little about. As an artist herself, she uses reclaimed wood to create creature-like pieces that tell a story. And right now, she has an exhibit at the Museum for Art in Wood in Philadelphia. Katie spoke with Rob Ferret about the art program and what she considers the language of woodworking. You also hear from a visit producer Mackenzie Crummy took to her studio recently.
Wood is one among many materials we could create art from. Mm-hmm. I get the impression that it is a very special material for you to create art with. What is it about wood?
It's a beautiful material, and I think, like, if you sort of think about where it appears in your life, like, if you think about the building that we're in, it's all concrete and steel, and wood tends to come in our domestic spaces, in our comfortable private spaces. It's the floors and the ceilings and the furniture and the objects that we sort of work with on a daily basis. And so one of the things I think is magical about it is that we as human beings have this relationship with it. It feels like a member of the family.
People might think woodworking as, you know, really practical carpentry, right, or construction, and you're bringing art into the equation, which people do. What is different about the kind of artwork you're doing as part of your woodworking?
That's a great question. I think, you know, wood is just a material like any other material, like clay or steel or anything else, and it can be used artistically or it can be used sort of practically.
poplar is a domestic lumber, meaning it grows in North America, and it's fast growing, and it is relatively easy to carve, and it's fairly inexpensive because of how fast growing it is. So it's a really great beginning wood sort of lumber. It's good, it's solid, you make furniture out of it, it's going to be plenty strong, but it is a little softer than some of our other hardwood species because it grows a little faster.
What I'm sort of doing in my practice is trying to weave together this material that we think of as being utilitarian and make objects that sort of feel like they could be functional or furnitural. So they sort of live in an imagined space that could be a real space. Like they're a little bit something you recognize and then they're a little bit foreign. And so there's this kind of like buzz between a thing that almost makes sense but then doesn't quite.
This is sort of an elaborate box for a chess set.
Wow.
The box is circular and sort of it's split into quadrants, and two of the quadrants on top, the sort of the top half of the circle sort of like unfold apart and open on wooden hinges. And then the pieces are in the cavity in the middle sort of part of the column. And so the pieces for this are actually where I started. I whittled a chess set during the pandemic. That's what I did. I whittled a bunch of other things too, but I started making these little pieces. They were all off of these little offcuts. And they were just little blocks of wood, 3/4 by 3/4 by 1.5 inches. They were all cut off from something. And I carved little legs in them. I gave them these little tiny faces. And it was really, really fun. It was fun to sort of figure out what my version of chess looked like.
If somebody's working with clay, they can kind of do what they want with it. If it's paint, you pick your colors, whatever. I think of wood as like, you know, when a sculptor talks about, yeah, the art is there. I'm just like chipping away the bits that aren't the art, right? Wood comes with some parameters, right, that you have to work around.
It does. My friend B.A. Harrington, who was actually a grad student in this program many years ago, always talks about having empathy with the material, and wood is one of those materials where you really have to listen to it. It has a grain, it has a direction, and when you're working with it, you have to be paying attention to what it's saying, because even if you know the material pretty well, each board is unique, and the grain might be doing something slightly different than you think it's doing. So for sure, it definitely tells you what it wants to do and what it doesn't want to do.
Now, when I think wood, I could be talking about a log or processed, you know, lumber. And you are often starting with recycled, reclaimed wood materials. What kind of things are you looking for, say, on moving day on a college campus?
I'm looking for older stuff. For me, when I'm sort of like wandering around moving day, or if I am driving sort of down one of Madison's streets, you know, so often people will put stuff out to the curb, not as trash, but in the hopes that somebody like me will come along and want to pick it up. My scrap bin is huge and quite full, and all under here is scraps. I call them hunker chunkers, the like chunks of wood that are still good, but they're quite small, like I kind of will take all the little weird scraps that nobody else wants. I have drawers, you know, over here. You know, if I need these, I call these niblets. If I need like a little wood niblet, that's where I go. And then I've got, you know, the fancy wood niblets. These are going to be denser woods, exotics and stuff. But again, I'm not buying them. Friends will give me chunks that are too small for them to use, or every once in a while somebody throws away a piano and you'll sort of see me kind of like peeling off some of the the keys and the black keys.
Now we'll get back into what you're doing with that wood you found in a bit. I want to talk about the woodworking program at UW that you're working in. As I understand it, fairly unique. Not every place has something like this. What's going on there? What makes it different and special?
Well, what's cool about it, it's in the art department, and we, of course, have an incredible sculpture program. We have a great ceramic program. We have a glassblowing program. UW-Madison's art department is incredible. But the woodworking program is very specifically for woodworking and furniture design. Students can make more sculptural things, or they can make sort of furniture objects in our classes. And we're teaching them how to build with this material in kind of the traditions of woodworking, teaching joinery, teaching carving, sort of talking about furniture anatomy a little bit, how things go together and why, because because that material is weird. So, right, like how do you work with it and make it strong? Why do the joints exist? So we're really, it isn't just coming from like a sculptural standpoint of what material works the best for my sort of artistic concept. It's more like, here's wood, what can you do with it? This is how it acts. This is how it works. So there's a really kind of a fun deep dive. There's a real sort of like depth to the kind of knowledge that they get. We start off with a PowerPoint every semester of what wood is on a cellular level and why it works the way it does.
It's very practical, but it sounds like there's kind of an element of play going
on
here.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, my students are, some of them are art majors, some of them are not. And we have dentistry students who come in and learn how to carve, which I know is going to help them carve somebody's teeth someday, right? We have engineers who come in, and I know they're going to be engineering with this material that they may never have gotten to use before. We have art students that may never use it again in their practice, but they'll be able to look at the shelves in their rental home or in their home and say, I can change the size of those. They'll look at the chair that they're sitting in and say, I can cut those legs down because I'm only 5'2", and this chair isn't comfortable for me. So wherever they want to sort of like take that material, they can. But I do want them to know that they are allowed to, they have permission to, and that it can be just as much a playful endeavor as it is a practical one.
And Haley, do you mind if I flip that?
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to try clamping this up. And look at that seam. You see any problems with it?
Like right here still. It
looks better than it did. I think there's a little bit of chip. But the shape is also going to be cut out of this. So you're going to lose the ends,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to check the other side real quick. We're off a little bit. I'm offset. But that seam now looks really clean. And when we sand it back to the sander, it'll clean it up.
I think we're going to be good.
Okay. You ready to glue this puppy?
Yep.
All right, do you have a pencil?
No, I'll glue it.
Will you grab one?
And I would think if somebody was taking some recycled material to make furniture out of, their first thought might be, okay, how do I disguise the fact that it's different pieces? How do I make this look uniform? And you go the opposite way.
I do go the opposite way. I want the pieces to feel like they're unified, but not uniform. Mm-hmm. So when I take these sort of found materials and I build a piece from them, I am sort of looking for like a unifying visual language to kind of apply to all the parts, but I'm absolutely fine with somebody being able to sort of come in and see, oh, this might have come from something and this might have come from something else. They may not know what exactly, but I want to honor the fact that these materials started off as trash, and I'm not trying to hide that.
We're talking about artistic woodworking with Katie Hudnall, who leads the UW-Madison Woodworking and Furniture Program. Why did we get into some of the things that you create? I was looking at your website. You've got a furniture section, but I think my favorite was a section called Furniture-ish.
Yes.
What is Furniture-ish?
Well, Furniture-ish is those projects that, again, you know, like sort of going back to the beginning of the conversation, is a little bit those things that might have drawers, they might have handles. They will appear to sort of the average everyday person who maybe is not that interested in art as an object that you could interact with in a furniture way. But they do something a little bit different. Sometimes they become sort of like elaborate cabinets to hold a very special object. This was like a little funny demo cabinet that I made.
That's so fun.
And this little thing, it'll get slats on the front and the back of it, but it's when I finish a pencil in my shop, when my pencils get so short that I can't sharpen them anymore, I save them. And then when I have time, I make them like coffins, basically. I make them little final resting spots. And so this is sort of the latest version of that.
Oh, why do you love your pencils so much?
Well, they've just drawn so many lines. Like, I think that there are really beautiful, like, a few reasons. Like, it took me years and years and years to get to a place where I was settled enough that I used my pencils all the way up before I lost them. And so I sort of want to honor that. And I like the idea that that this thing that has drawn so many lines for me now has a special space where I can sort of remember it. Like, these become reminders of how much work I have done. Because sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm not doing enough work. I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And so it's just sort of nice to honor those. And they're beautiful objects, you know, like there's something really lovely. A pencil, like, that's only a 1 inch long is still kind of like everything that you need to draw a line.
another project that struck me. I want to make sure I have this right. You created a machine for the purpose of dropping a maple seed.
I did, yes. It's an 11-foot tall, sort of creature-like, very, very thin wood object. It stands on three legs, and then it has this sort of long neck. People say it looks like a giraffe sometimes, or they say it looks like a dinosaur sometimes. And it goes up to this very, very small sort of like wooden pincher up at the top. And a string runs down from that pincher to a lever at sort of hand height. When you push that lever, it just opens those pinchers, and they hold a maple seed, a maple helicopter. And it's 11 feet tall because I figured out that's how tall you have to be for this particular sort of maple seed that I have to actually catch the wind and spin at least part of the way down. And it's so much fun. When I release it in front of people, which I just got to do in Philadelphia for the opening, like everybody in the audience gasps when it catches the air. And I think that's so lovely. And it's something we usually just ignore. So, yeah, it feels really special to me.
So it captures our focus for that, however 3 seconds or however long it takes to drop to the ground.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of work for 3 seconds of joy. And I think that's easy to sort of be reminded of or to find value in, because I have made this crazy elaborate 11-foot tall sculpture and brought it inside, and all of the sort of trappings of a museum have made it feel important. And I think what I'm hoping is that sculpture then reminds people to go back out into the world and pay attention to the season of maple seed helicopters falling to the ground.
It's a slow process, it sounds like. And that is part of the appeal to you, and something that I think a lot of people might actually appreciate in a world where we get stuff quickly in many cases.
Totally. I love working slowly. I like the way that it makes me slow down. I like kind of exploring or coming to understand the thing that I'm trying to do with my hands as much as with my head. There are times when I'm carving and I'm not sure what I'm going to do with a piece. And it's really sort of this connection that kind of bypasses my brain and is really just like this conversation between my hands and my eyes. And I think that that's a really wonderful space to be in, and one that we just don't let ourselves be in very much anymore.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This is awesome.
That is Katie Hudnall, who leads UW-Madison's woodworking and furniture program, and she spoke with Rob Ferret. Special thanks to technical director Sarah Hopeful for sound design. And hey, if you follow Wisconsin Public Radio on social media, did you know we have two Facebook feeds in addition to the one called Wisconsin Public Radio? You can also follow us at WPR Music, Arts, and Culture. It's all about the creative culture around the state and people doing interesting things in communities like yours, perhaps working with wood. And be sure to follow Wisconsin Public Radio on Instagram. Our feed will keep you up to speed on the news, and you can see extra pictures and videos to go along with the stories you hear on the air. Stay connected. As we hear about making art out of trees, let's make some space to find out about your woodworking projects or wood pieces that are special to you. Have you made wood furniture? What was that process like? Did you get stuck at any point? Is there a story about a piece in your family that holds special significance? Maybe it's a toy box or bunk beds or a kitchen table or a bookcase. Share about woodworking and the craftsmanship in it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can reach out with a text or voicemail. That number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Courtney Everett, Trevor Hook, and Mackenzie Crummie. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.